Tonight, I'm talking about the nature of suffering. In the meditation, having used the word suffering now about six times, I guess, I want to distinguish that word in English from the Pali word dukkha, which is so much more what I mean and what most Buddhist teachers talk about when they use the word suffering. Because, and I've said this before, it's worth saying again, most of us think of suffering as nasty things happening and we're miserable as a result. And the two things kind of melt together in our minds. Whereas dukkha in Pali means specifically the suffering, the distress, the emotional feeling that we have in response to events. We're living in this world of constant change. Things happen. Some of them we like. Some of them we like a lot. Some of them we don't like. Others we fear or hate or whatever. That response is dukkha. Unless it's one that is completely without clinging. All of our responses have in them what I talked about recently, the roots of suffering. Again, in Pali, it's the word vedana. And it's a reaction that's so instantaneous, it's really beyond our control. We either like it, or we don't like it, or we're neutral. And this response is magnified by our history, the things that have happened to us, our reactions to them, that have formed mental habits. I like that phrase. It's the attitudes that we've acquired, the assumptions that we've made, and that get deeper and deeper in our psyches as time goes by, and our values, and of course our preferences. I'm always going to like chocolate. Vanilla? Nah. So all of these mental habits generate thoughts and physical sensations. Together, I think most psychologists, for example, would think of these as emotions, thoughts, and physical sensations. I want to really kind of focus on the physical sensations, feelings, things that we feel. Because we live with so much attention paid, focused on events and our thinking about those events, to the extent that we're usually pretty unaware of our feelings, the physical sensations. And in fact, there are a lot of people who even believe that emotions are what we're thinking about events. I'm teaching the online Introduction to Meditation class again, and I have to walk people through even finding their feelings because they want to tell me the story of what's happened. And then what they said, and what she said, and what he did. And it takes a while to find feelings. and then to cultivate a real relationship with them. We get so attached to the story and keep telling ourselves that story as long as we're upset. And the cruel irony is that we think we can think our way out of our feelings without recognizing them, without acknowledging them. But they will continue as long as we continue that story. The cycle perpetuates dukkha. And this is why I'm always saying, get out of the story and into the body. That takes energy away from the thinking, breaks that cycle, and it has many, many other benefits, which I hope the rest of my talk will explain. So 25 years ago, I'm a relatively successful attorney sitting in my office where I'm a partner doing my work, and all of a sudden, my right arm and my head started moving on their own. I did not decide to do this. What I started to do was freak out. And stories immediately went through my head about how awful and horrifying this was. How can this be happening to me? Will it stop? Or will it ruin my life? How can I go to court if something like this happens? How can I argue with another attorney? And one of the greatest blessings of my life happened right then, because I knew not to continue those thoughts. I had studied Buddhism in college and graduate school, and I was familiar with the 12 steps. And I knew the power of acceptance. So I accepted that whatever this was, it had happened. And it was less than a second. I realized that all I could do about what had happened was deal with it. You know, I couldn't make it unhappen. This practice of meditation helped with a lot of the other symptoms that came along. The doctor, the neurologist, told me that I had a movement disorder that it's in the category of Parkinson's or multiple sclerosis, but it doesn't have a name of its own. It turns out that neurologists don't know a lot of things. And what this is one of them, but they know what's happening in the brain. They just don't know why. And there aren't enough people with what I call Rebecca Dixon's disease to give it any other name. So it's an orphan disease. But it has symptoms, and almost all of them have been helped a lot by this practice, because they're very sensitive to dukkha. It's sort of like plant food to them. They, you know, it makes them grow. So I have returned over and over and over to the Four Noble Truths. And the key point to them is that they have no pronouns. Pronouns. There are no yours or theirs or mine. It's just dukkha arises. Dukkha is caused by. Dukkha can be ended. And here's the way to end dukkha. So it's not something to take personally. And, you know, what do we think of as more personal than the fact that I'm unhappy? But it's a universal phenomenon. It's not just yours. Just like thoughts, dukkha arises, it changes, and it passes away. So it isn't me, and it isn't mine. It's a phenomenon, just like everything else. It's like we all have the same keys on our emotional pianos. You'd see a photograph of anyone from anywhere in the world, and you see a bunch of them, and they have facial expressions. It doesn't matter what culture that person's from, what language they speak, you're going to recognize what emotion they're having from their facial expression. We know what other people's emotions are. We just have different takes on them. It's like sometimes you're pounding those piano keys hard, or you're just like a world-class pianist. You're playing them so delicately. And for some people, there are keys they never use. Others, they've just got 4 or 5. I've known a lot of people who just had anger. That was it. Pretty much the only thing they felt. And this is dictated, this different way of playing the universal forms of dukkha. It's determined by those mental habits that I mentioned before, the attitudes, the assumptions, the values, the preferences. They're just sort of like the wallpaper. They're in our minds all the time, and they have a very powerful influence on the way we're responding to things at any moment. So seeing the universality of dukkha is key to what Gil Fronsdale calls a realistic, healthy compassion that does not drown us. You know, a lot of people are afraid to be compassionate because they take on what they imagine the other person is feeling. And first of all, we can't ever really do that. I mean, we can imagine it and we can have this sort of vicarious suffering, but it doesn't do the other person or us any good, really. So the kind of compassion that Gil is talking about will not grind us away. It will not drown us. Whether we're seeing all of the suffering throughout the world or in the people we love, or in ourselves, we can have a compassion recognizing our universality that just sees that dukkha has arisen and it can pass away. This is the moment when this being is suffering in that way. There will be a moment when I suffer in that way, etc., etc. But we're all in this together. We share our dukkha with all beings, and so compassion has to be in a universal direction, global, toward ourselves and all beings equally. Now, in my experience, this universality of dukkha makes my own suffering easier to bear. Because for one thing, and I think this is a big thing for a lot of people, there's no reason to blame anyone for experiencing dukkha. Now, it's something that comes from within, and so there's a tendency to feel, why am I doing this to myself? I am so stupid that I always put myself through this. Well, that's another arrow. You know, dukkha is the second arrow, and the fourth, and the 19th, and the 270th, and now another arrow. So we just stop. That's all. Get out of the story. Out of the story. Into the body. Stop shooting the arrows. So with this dukkha, this blameless, guilt-free dukkha that just arises, what do we do besides not shooting more arrows? Well, in the hospice, when I saw that a patient was in pain, I would go get a nurse and tell him or her that we have a patient who's in pain and probably needs some medication. So address the event and deal with the suffering through this practice. The teachings on the Four Noble Truths tell us how to deal with dukkha. The first noble truth is that dukkha exists. So this truth of dukkha is to be fully understood. The second noble truth is that the cause of dukkha is clinging, which is caused by vedana that has grown into greed, hatred, or delusion. So this clinging is to be abandoned. The third noble truth is that dukkha can be ended. And this is to be realized. And that's based on experience. And the fourth noble truth is that the way to end dukkha is the Eightfold Path. And that Eightfold Path is to be developed in our lives. So that's how you deal with it. Understand, abandon, realize, and follow the Eightfold Path. Now I'll try to explain those. To understand dukkha, we have to study it. It seems daunting to face into our own suffering, but it's the same principle as a sailboat out on the seas. If the wind and the waves come up, you face into them. Don't let them hit you sideways. Don't try to run away from it. Face into it. Remember, that dukkha is not yours. You're borrowing it from the universe. And another thing, do this while you're meditating. Face into the suffering. When you have a calm and stable mind to hold that experience. And start with the little stuff, minor irritations, like, you know, you order takeout, you know, you've been wanting rice and beans with a taco or whatever and some salad. You know, I really like refried beans, refritos. I want to get my rice and refritos. So I order and I go and I get my meal, pay for it, get home, and it's black beans. Okay, stuff like that, you know? You felt it. You know what that feels like. Start with that feeling. Don't start with the Holocaust. Don't start with a lover who's betrayed you. You know, easy stuff, refritos. Ajahn Sumedho, and about a zillion other teachers, says, to let go of suffering, we have to admit it into consciousness. What does it feel like to get black beans? You know? Let it in. Study it. Feel it. Physical sensations. What prompted that groan? And remember, that dukkha is not yours and it's not your fault. Just allow it into this unguarded, accepting, and kind awareness. It's like being fully present with a friend in the hospital. And for your sake, without reactivity or blaming anyone for whatever put them in the hospital. And don't take on what you imagine their suffering to be. It's just their turn for this experience. It's your turn for this dukkha. So get to know how dukkha feels in your awareness. Get to know the whole range of your piano playing. Where is the sensation located? What are its physical attributes? Jack Kornfield walked me through this exercise many years ago, asking, is it hot or cold? Is it soft or hard? Is it steady? Or does it come and go? Does it change? Is it strong or weak? On and on and on. Until I had a pretty good description, a pretty good understanding of what I was feeling. And when you know dukkha as it arises in your awareness, then practice with the second noble truth, abandoning the cause of dukkha. You will have gotten to see the thoughts that precede those distressing sensations. Most likely they are the cause of that dukkha. Thought, sensation, causal relationship. So abandon those thoughts. Turn your attention to the body. Focus on it. Practice and get good at it. And each time this exercise stops your distress, know that you have ended dukkha. That's what it means to realize the third noble truth, that dukkha can be ended. Gill compared this exercise to trimming the small branches on the bush of dukkha. You trim off those branches and the bush is still there. Remember that dukkha is influenced by our pre-existing mind states, mental habits. And they're still there. What we're dealing with this thought and sensation is the end manifestation of this root. So ending these deeper causes of dukkha is a job for insight, wearing a bright red cape, coming as the bat signal is sent out over the city. We can invite insight to come, but we can't command it. And we invite it by staying with the physical sensations of dukkha. Staying and staying with them as long as they're there. Staying with them with compassion and steady attention. watch those sensations change, pass away, and come again, as long as it's there. Why? Because this creates the conditions for insight to arise. We have studied the dukkha. And it's not like reading a textbook. The answer, the conclusion, isn't the last sentence and the last paragraph. It's a shift in the way our mind is put together. And we can't do that consciously. It has to happen. But we can create the conditions for it to happen. And when insight comes, it will reveal to us the mental habits that are at the root of that kind of suffering, the roots of that bush of suffering. And those insights will dig up the root and the branches and every part of that. So months or years later, you're going to notice that you're not having that kind of dukkha anymore. And that's how you practice with the third noble truth. You have realized that that kind of suffering has ended. So this is a process. And even though it's often summed up by the phrase letting go, it requires often kind of heroic patience and perseverance. These, by the way, are from the paramis, the perfections, that are traits that we cultivate because they lead to freedom. They enable us to do this practice, to keep at it. But as you can see, it works. And there is really no other way. I will go to court and swear and testify. This works because I have realized the end of suffering many, many times. And there are many whole bushes of dukkha that I just don't have to deal with anymore. So Ajahn Sumedho says, even when I had the insight that allowed me to let go, I did let go for a moment, but then I started grasping again by thinking, I can't do it. I have so many bad habits. But don't trust that kind of nagging, disparaging thinking in yourself. It is totally untrustworthy. It is just a matter of practicing, letting go. The more you begin to see how to do it, then the more you are able to sustain the state of non-attachment. Ajahn also reminds us that our notion of ourselves can sabotage this process, big time. We hate to see traits and habits in ourselves that conflict with our ideal self-image. How many times have we seen them in the mirror of our minds that we're not what we want to be? So that clinging to that self-image really is the mother root of all of the bushes, of all of the suffering. We don't want to. We don't want to see it. So far too often we don't see it, even though we must in order to end dukkha. Therefore, it is so important to have the four divine abodes, those places of refuge in ourselves, of kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Because they bypass this particularly nasty form of dukkha called self-dukkha. And this process that I've described of the Eightfold Path with the Four Noble Truths is how the mind is purified of the causes of dukkha. It is not annihilation of yourself by any means. Instead, it's a process of freeing us to be calmer, wiser, and happier than we can imagine even our perfect self might be. Thank you.